the Psychobilly record label, and Psychobilly US, that is, if you're keeping track and want to look them up online. Psychobilly US in the Hairball 8 record label is who has Coffin Cats right now, and we're going to do just one for you before we leave, and that's it for the Wrecking Hours this week. Stay tuned next week for more Rockabilly and Psychobilly.
This is WHFR, Dearborn.
Disclaimer, this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our board of trustees, or students.
A pilgrimage to the New Mexico desert and the very large array, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome to the travel show that takes you to the final frontier. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society. You may have heard me mention that I was traveling in New Mexico a few weeks ago. Today, we present the first of three great stories I covered there as we visit with Dale Frail, director of the great radio telescope known as the Very Large Array. First, though, we'll check in with Emily Lakdawalla for the Best of the Planetary Society blog. Emily, we got other things to talk about, but first, you've got a couple of book reviews, and both of these books are beautiful. One of them, of course, we just featured on the show not too many weeks ago.
That's right. That one's The Beauty of Space, written by actually quite a number of members of the International Association of Astronomical Artists, also known as the IAAA. And then one member of that organization, Michael Carroll, wrote a really wonderful book about the meteorology of all the worlds with atmospheres in our solar system. And I have to say about this book, I've tried to read about planetary weather before, and it generally puts me right to sleep. But Michael Carroll's book, Drifting on Alien Winds, was really great, so I highly recommend it. And, of course, the illustrations are lovely because he's an artist.
And, oh, my God, that image that you have in the blog from inside Saturn's atmosphere, I want to see that as part of a Jim Cameron movie. It's incredibly beautiful. We'll go right on. And the reason I want to talk about this is that it's this fascinating juxtaposition, two consecutive blog entries, one about Phobos sample return, also known as Phobos grunt or grunt, and MSL, Mars Science Laboratory.
It's no coincidence, of course, that these two spacecraft are getting ready to launch at the same time, because after all, Mars launch windows only open up once every 2 years or so. And both of these missions missed their launch window the last time around, so they've been waiting for 26 months to get another chance. Curiosity, the Mars Science Laboratory rover, has just been stacked on top of its rocket. I read this morning that Phobos Grunt, along with its Chinese mini-satellite payload Yinghuo 1, are also now on top of their rocket, and they're, I think, standing ready on the launch pad now, getting ready for what'll be a November 9th launch in Moscow time, but it's November 8th to us. So some of you who are listening to this now, the spacecraft, who knows, it may already be in space.
Yes, let's hope so. Emily has assembled lots of other great documentation that you won't find anywhere else in the blog at planetary.org.
Yep, and I'll talk with you next week, hopefully about a successful Russian launch.
Yes, yes, devoutly to be wished. She is Emily Lakdawalla, the Science and Technology Coordinator for the Planetary Society, also a contributing editor to Sky and Telescope magazine with some new things to read there.
That's right. In fact, in both of those jobs, I have contributed articles on the Curiosity rover, both Sky and Tel and the Planetary Report.
From Emily to our other regular commentator, Bill Nye, the science and planetary guy. Bill, as usual, you've been a busy guy. A second trip to New Orleans.
That's right. I spoke with the teachers of gifted children, and I got them excited about planetary science. You know, as we say, there's nothing more engaging than space. Every kid is fascinated. I mean, everybody is fascinated by space. So I got the teachers excited about it. I think we're going to get an opportunity to use our new kids section, our new kids and educational materials with the teachers that face pretty sharp kids 5 days a week. It's very exciting.
Speaking of people getting excited about planetary science, you and I had personal experience of congressional staffers getting excited in that trip we made a few weeks ago, and it just happened again.
That's right. We took advantage. We sent Scott Hubbard, Dr. Hubbard, Dr. Heidi Hamill, Dr. Jim Bell to the Rayburn Building there in Washington, D.C., and they, once again, along with Robert Zubrin.
Yes, the Mad Martian.
Yes. They gave the staffers, and I think a few members of Congress directly, an earful about the importance of planetary science and the importance, really, if you're in the United States, the importance of NASA supporting it, because it brings out the best in us, and it's a very good value for taxpayers and voters. It's not that expensive a business compared to the technical and scientific return you get. And speaking of Mars, Matt, this is when Phobos Life leaves this week.
Came up in conversation with Emily. We'll probably talk a bit more about it with Bruce because he's a big part of that project on behalf of the Planetary Society. But you as the executive director must be pretty proud of this.
Oh, yeah. This thing's taken years. And so this is just a cool little idea. What happens if you send living things, albeit freeze-dried microscopic living things, sealed in polyimide plastic and titanium, what if you send those near Mars and back for 3 years? Do they survive? Do they change? Do they mutate somehow? Well, we'll find out. And I talked this over with the planetary protection people at NASA, and they at first were dismissive, but after a while they realized it's a pretty good idea. They just hadn't thought of it. So it starts on Tuesday or Wednesday of this week. Very cool.
Very exciting, too.
So we keep chipping away at these things, Matt, and we chip away at the politics here in the United States, and we'll see if we can't get everybody in the world engaged in planetary science. For what, Matt? Why? For the betterment of humankind. Is that so wrong? I got to fly Bill Nye the Planetary Guy.
He's Bill Nye the Planetary Guy, the Planetary and Science Guy, and he's the Executive Director of the Planetary Society. Back in a minute to talk about the Very Large Array. You can help give it a new name. So that sound you hear in the background is the security guard at the VLA turning around. He was just making sure that I actually had business out here. I got here just after dark. I mean, there's still a little bit of light up in the sky. Stretching out in front of me like these pale white ghosts are the individual antennas of the VLA. It's quite a sight. I wish I'd been here half hour ago when I could see them better, but in a way, this is even more romantic. It is a beautiful place to do astronomy. No, I couldn't resist that long drive into the desert where I could finally see, barely, the Very Large Array for myself. And imagine I was Jodie Foster in the movie Contact, listening to our universe. An hour or so to the east is the Socorro, New Mexico headquarters of this great radio telescope. That's where I sat down with its director, Dale Frail. You'll hear Dale mention not only the VLA, but the VLBA, or Very Long Baseline Array, which is the continent-sized version of the great radio telescope. We have links to learn more about both at planetary.org/radio. That's where you can also learn more about how you might be able to rename a newly upgraded VLA. How long have you been here?
I arrived here in December 1989.
And a fairly recent development. You're becoming the director of this facility.
Right. I've been in the job for 2.5 months. I'm the director of the VLA and the VLBA here in New Mexico. I've used the VLA especially for the last 20 years or more used it to study the death of massive stars, gamma ray bursts, pulsars, soft gamma ray repeaters. Basically, big explosions is what I like to do the best.
Did the VLA offer capabilities for the kind of research that you wanted to do, which particularly in the early years just weren't available elsewhere?
Well, the VLA has always been the most sensitive radio telescope for the kind of work that I wanted to do. Being here on the staff and being at the telescope made it possible for me to do many of the things that I did that I could not have done if I had not been here.
The history of this place, I mean, I already mentioned Jodie Foster, and of course that's a reference to the movie Contact, and that somewhat fanciful scene of her sitting out on a mesa or something with the big antennas in the background with her headphones on. Not exactly the way SETI was conducted, I don't think, was it?
No, not at all. It's the romantic view of the movie, of course, is quite disappointing in real life. Most of us scientists today sit in our office and next to our laptop or our computer, and the data comes streaming in. So it's not quite that romantic vision you have of listening to radio waves.
When it first started in operation, what set the VLA apart from other radio telescope facilities that, of course, have been around for many years?
The big thing that set it apart was its adaptability. It was a very versatile, highly sensitive telescope. By moving the 27 antennas that make up the Very Large Array, you could turn it into an instrument that was capable of seeing very fine detail, or you could zoom it out so that you could see very broad detail. And so it had that ability to do everything from comets down to the early universe. So you could study very fine details like black holes, or you could study the diffuse gas between galaxies. So it gave you that complete range of topics that you could study.
How do you take the signal from so many dishes spread across the desert floor and turn that into one magnificent image?
We use the technique of interferometry, and we combine the signals using radio processing techniques of the 27 antennas. We combine and multiply those signals together, and we Fourier transform that signal and make a final image. And there's a lot of steps in there, but basically we're combining the signals from all 27 antennas.
Did it work exactly as expected right from the beginning? I mean, this was something new was being tried here.
There was a commissioning phase of the telescope, and it lasted several years. And the telescope now is currently undergoing an upgrade from those early days. And we are experiencing all again, fresh again, the joys of commissioning a brand new telescope.
What were the kinds of things that the VLA was able to do for our knowledge of the universe that simply didn't exist before?
Right. For 20 years, it was probably the most productive. It was the most productive ground-based radio telescope in the world. And it worked on everything from the spin of Mercury to basically identifying the first explosions in the earliest phase of the universe, these gamma ray bursts that I've worked on. So that whole spread from our solar system to the lives of stars to the formation of galaxies to the death of stars, that whole range of topics, that it's touched on every aspect of modern astrophysics. There's no part of modern astrophysics that the VLA has not been involved in.
You talked about an upgrade. What's been going on with that, and is that now complete?
We are 1 year away from completing the VLA upgrade. We call it the Expanded Very Large Array. For a fairly modest amount of money, we have been able to increase the capabilities of the large array, the Very Large Array, by about a factor of 10 in sensitivity, in bandwidth. And in some capabilities, we've been actually gotten factors of 10 to 100 times more improvement. Basically, the way I describe it is that we're ripping out the plumbing and installing modern electronics. So we're keeping the old antennas. The antennas are perfectly sound. They're in great shape. But when the VLA was built, we didn't have fiber optics. We didn't have modern digital electronics. And so we're putting in all these modern digital devices and the fiber optics. And that's where we get most of our improvement.
What's the status of the upgrade?
It's going very well. We're on time. We're on budget. We have 1 year left. We have kept the telescope open during the entire decade that we've been renovating the telescope. And our community, about 700 people a year use the telescope. And on any given day, we can have a group from Australia using the telescope, a group from Princeton. We can have a group from Italy using the telescope. Around the world, it's a complete world telescope.
Gamma ray bursts, a particularly frightening topic to me, as my colleague Bruce Betts knows. I saw a reference to you as one of the top three people in the world with expertise in this area.
I got involved in gamma ray bursts very early on in the study of their afterglows, so that my colleagues and myself were one of the among the groups that identified the so-called afterglows from gamma ray bursts. After the explosion, there is a fading remnant in the X-rays and the optical and the radio. And we were the group that identified the fading radio afterglow from these events, and we were the group that also measured the redshift. So we've been quite involved in the last 15 years or so on gamma ray bursts in a very close way.
And when you say you measured the redshift, was there some question up to that point as to what the origin of these were and how far away they were?
Yes, they had been discovered in the early 70s, and they had been a mystery about 25 years in the making. They had for about 25 years, we did not know how far away they were. We literally did not know whether they were occurring in our solar system or whether they were occurring on the edge of space. By measuring their redshift, by determining their distance, we were able to break that puzzle. We were able to show that these are related to the death of massive stars early in the age of the universe, around the time when the universe was forming most of its massive stars. So we were able to show that they were a cosmological population.
More from Dale Frail, director of the Very Large Array, in a minute. This is Planetary Radio.
I'm Robert Picardo. I traveled across the galaxy as the Doctor in Star Trek Voyager. Then I joined the Planetary Society to become part of the real adventure of space exploration. The Society fights for missions that unveil the secrets of the solar system. It searches for other intelligences in the universe, and it built the first solar sail. It also shares the wonder through this radio show, its website, and other exciting projects that reach around the globe. I'm proud to be part of this greatest of all voyages, and I hope you'll consider joining us.
You can learn more about the Planetary Society at our website, planetary.org/radio, or by calling 1-800-9-WORLDS. Planetary Radio listeners who aren't yet members can join and receive a Planetary Radio t-shirt. Our nearly 100,000 members receive the internationally acclaimed Planetary Report magazine. That's planetary.org/radio. The Planetary Society, exploring new worlds.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan. On the first leg of my recent New Mexico trip, I stopped in Socorro for a visit with Dale Frail. He's the longtime scientist at the Very Large Array, who now directs that historic and very active radio telescope, along with the continent-spanning Very Large Baseline Array, or VLBA. I was talking with Dale before the break about those greatest of all explosions of energy, GRBs. Quick sidelight question. How silly am I to be worried about a direct hit from a gamma ray burst on our whereabouts?
It's fairly unlikely. I think you would be hit by 100 supernovae before you'd be hit by one gamma ray burst.
I'm not as reassured as I would like to be, but I'll settle for that. We were talking before we started recording about some of the other work that you've done, including discovery of extrasolar planets. In fact, you were responsible for, or part of a team that was responsible for, was it really the very first one?
1992, Alex Volshan and I were the first team that found a planetary system orbiting around a pulsar. That's been confirmed, and we have a multiple planetary system. And the work that I did was done here at the VLA, and Alex Volshan did his work at the Arecibo Telescope in Puerto Rico.
Has the VLA been a part of other discoveries of extrasolar planets? I don't usually hear about radio astronomy having a part in that.
Radio astronomy has two roles. I would say the EVLA, which is this expanded very large array that we're working on right now, one of the key science things the very large array can do is now study protoplanetary disks. So the VLA is sensitive to that phase in the evolution of planets and the disks that from planets are formed when the material is about the size of little rocks. So it's that pre-planetary formation stage that is captured by the VLA. And we have as a key science project at the Very Large Array right now a project to study protoplanetary disks. The second area where I think the VLA can play a significant role is in the detection of Jovian planets. Jupiter is a known radio source at low frequencies, and we are building here a low-frequency system that will be capable of detecting Jupiter-like planets around normal stars.
That's amazing. I mean, what kind of sensitivity are we talking about? I know Jupiter is a very strong radio source, but we're talking about sources that are pretty far away.
Right. We can, with the VLA sensitivity, the upgrade that we're planning, we can reach out quite far in the nearby planetary environment and look for these super Jupiters, look for these radio flares from these Jupiter-like planets. And we'll be able to monitor a comparable region of space that the optical facilities can look at now for these flares.
We both have jumped some time zones, apparently. You just came back from Chile. What was going on there?
I went out to see one of our other sister telescopes that we're building in the southern hemisphere. It's called ALMA, and I went up to the high side at ALMA, which was at about 15,000 feet, and saw the telescopes that they're building up there on the mountaintop.
That's become quite a center for astronomy, but this move into radio astronomy, that's a new one to me.
Right. The ALMA telescope is being developed by NREO and its partners, and it is opening up a new window in the radio universe. The VLA observes the centimeter range of the spectrum. What ALMA will be able to do is open up the millimeter and submillimeter part of the spectrum. And ALMA and EVLA are being built as very complementary facilities. The science is complementary, and together they will make a very, very powerful pair of telescopes.
So just as optical telescopes might specialize in different parts of the spectrum, that's really what you're talking about.
Right. It's the difference between optical and, say, infrared. It's that sort of difference. And technically, the telescopes are very different. But scientifically, they have a lot of complementary aspects to offer. The frequency range that we observe with the VLA and ALMA overlaps slightly, and the part of the sky that they can observe also overlap. ALMA and EVLA science needs actually overlap quite a lot, and there are science that ALMA can do that naturally fold back into the EVLA and vice versa.
We're just about out of time. I want to give you a chance, though, to talk about a way for listeners to this program, other people to get involved, and that is you're looking for a new name for this new enhanced VLA.
Yes, we are. We have had the name The Very Large Array for three decades. We want to convey the idea to the community and the public at large that the Very Large Array is a brand new telescope now. It is a new instrument that will give us a new insight in the universe and allow us to use this telescope for another 10, 20, 30 years. And we've invited the public to get involved in giving us a name that matches the new science capabilities of this telescope.
How can people get in on this? Should they just go to the website?
NREO has a website called namethearray.org, and you can go to that website and make your suggestion.
And do it soon, because I think the deadline is coming up. What's that, December 1? We're looking over at Dave Finley here, who's on your staff and helped to set all this up today. I just one other question, because it is not just a place of discovery, but it seems to me to be a very special place, that the location itself has a certain romance to it. I mean, do you ever feel that?
I do. I need to go out there every once in a while to shake the dust off my time that I spend on a computer and the time that I spend in meetings. I find going out there reminds me of why I'm a scientist and why it's important to study the stars. And I'm particularly intrigued by the fact that whenever I go out there, I meet people who are super excited about the VLA and the science that we do. And the public at large is generally very supportive and excited about being at the VLA site.
What a great way to close. Dale, thank you so much for this. I really appreciate it. And good luck with that commissioning process, and hopefully many, many more discoveries to be made by the whatever the new name will be for the Very Large Array.
Thank you.
We've been talking with the director of operations for the NRAO in New Mexico. He is the director of the Very Large Array and the VLBA, which stands for?
The Very Long Baseline Array. That's the continental-sized array that's, a twin of the VLA, but on continental-sized baselines.
Well, several people have asked me to talk about the transition that I've made, where I'm now full-time at the Planetary Society, left my university job. One of the best things about this, of course, is that I should be able to record with Bruce Betts in person on a regular basis. And so here I am, sitting in your office. Welcome back to What's Up.
Thank you, and welcome to the office on a full-time basis, Matt.
What's up?
Oh, all of our shining faces with you here in the office, Matt. All right, but in addition, we've got Jupiter's the super bright star-like object over in the east. After sunset, you can see it near the moon on the 8th and the 9th, and still same part of the sky on the 10th. Also, this week, November 8th, 2005, YU-55, is an asteroid that will be coming closer to Earth than the Moon, a 400-meter asteroid. If such a thing hit Earth, it would cause quite the regional disaster, but no chance of that. Also, no chance of you seeing it with your naked eye, but can be seen with telescopes, and all sorts of observers will be training telescopes of the optical and radio and other varieties on it.
I was hoping to go out to Goldstone, the radio telescope, where they're going to be shooting radar at this thing, I guess, with our friend Emily. But I'm going to be up north with you at Stellar, as we call it around here, up in San Luis Obispo.
That's because they call it Stellar also. It's Stellar Explorations. Going to a solar sail mission review. We've also got the Leonids meteor shower peaking on November 17th, which has great PR, except for those times every 30, 33 years. Really pretty lame, probably, but I mention it. The increased meteor activity, you never know. We've also got Mars up in the middle of the night and then high overhead in the pre-dawn, and right now hanging out friends with Leo's brightest star, Regulus. Very similar brightness right now, but Mars, of course, reddish, and Regulus, white, blue, bluish, whitish.
Red, white, and blue.
Yeah. All right, we move on to this week in space history. And big week for Mars. 15 years ago, 1996, Mars Global Surveyor went into orbit. 40 years ago this week, Mariner 9, I have problems today. I don't know, it's just your proximity, I guess. Mariner 9 goes into orbit, becoming the first successful Mars orbiter. First thing to show us the whole planet.
I have that effect on people.
Yes, you do. We move on to random space fact. So today I've got some facts for you about Mars' moon Phobos, in honor of the Phobos sample return mission launch period opening this week. Launch to Mars' moon Phobos, including our Phobos Life microorganism experiment,
which people can look up at planetary.org. It's quite fascinating, very exciting.
So I thought I'd give you some weird facts about Mars' moon Phobos, some of which I've told you, some of which I haven't. Mars' moon Phobos orbits Mars in less than 8 hours. It's zippy. Since Mars has a similar length day, this means it actually goes from west to east, not east to west, in the Mars sky. Something new because it's so close to the surface compared to, say, our moon. It cannot be seen above the horizon at latitudes greater than 70 degrees.
Oh, really? It's just blocked by the planet itself?
It is indeed. Yeah. It's just that low. It's more analogous to a typical low Earth orbit spacecraft than it is to, say, the moon. And one last one, compared to Mars's other moon, Deimos, also small, but Phobos has about 10 times the mass.
I was just thinking that some NBA players would have to duck.
Well, I'm not saying it's that close. It's still, it'll be scary. I'll pull it off the top of my head, but I believe it's about 8,000 kilometers altitude. So only the tallest of the NBA players.
And the best paid, yes.
Yes. All right, let's go on to trivia. And I remind everyone again, no one named Matt has ever flown in space. But there were some Bruces who flew in space. And I asked you, what people named Bruce have flown in space? How'd we do, Matt?
We got lots of correct answers from folks. Just about everybody came up with the two Bruces who really flew in space. Bruce McCandless II and Bruce Melnick. And we could tell you lots more about them, but we have other things to talk about. I will tell you, though, that Ralph Bruder in Billings, Montana, has been 2 years since he's won. He is going to get the Planetary Radio T-shirt this week, so congratulations, Ralph. Would Bruce Willis count? We had that from several people.
No comment.
Randy Bottom thought that he heard someplace that Yuri Gagarin's middle name is Bruce.
Yes, in fact, most astronauts' middle names and cosmonauts' middle names are Bruce.
And they're from Australia, no doubt. Monty Python. You got to hear this one. This is from Kurt Lewis, who says that, you know, normally he tries to make a joke about the answer, but there's nothing funny about these two fine astronauts named Bruce. On the other hand, everything about Bruce Betts seems to make me giggle.
That's great. That makes me giggle. That's really nice. All right, pulling out something for the next trivia contest, partially out of my dark history. Ooh, it's a clue. With this Russian mission launching, what was the last Russian or Soviet interplanetary mission? And I'm looking for ones that actually made it beyond the Earth-Moon system. Successfully went interplanetary.
How do people enter?
Go to planetary.org/radio. Find out how to enter. Okay, everybody, go out there, look up in the night sky, and think about carpet cleaning. I think I have to. Isn't this place getting its carpets cleaned? Are you behind that? Did you complain?
They just wanted things to be spick and span for my arrival. I've already moved a whole bunch of stuff into the bathroom, which has tile floors. You have a lot of work ahead of you. See you later.
Later.
He's Bruce Betts, the Director of Projects for the Planetary Society, who joins us every week, live and in person, well, in person, for What's Up. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and made possible by a grant from the Kenneth T. and Eileen L. Norris Foundation. Clear skies.
Support for the Freakonomics Radio podcast comes from Intel, developing technology that creates new possibilities in industry, including healthcare, transportation, energy, retail, and education. More at intel.com/inside. Intel, sponsors of tomorrow. Support also comes from Stitcher Smart Radio, offering the Stitcher mobile app. With Stitcher's free app for mobile phones, listeners can get the latest episodes of Freakonomics, NPR, This American Life, and thousands of other podcasts on demand without downloading or syncing. This free Stitcher Smart Radio mobile app can be found in the iPhone or Android app stores or at stitcher.com/freak.
I'm Ed Rendell, former governor of Pennsylvania, former mayor of Philadelphia, former a lot of things.
And you know what we're here to talk about today, right?
Absolutely.
All right. Now, we've all heard, or some of us have heard at least, that Philadelphia is actually the capital of sports booing, at least.
Philadelphia fans are incredibly passionate. They're the best and most supportive fans in the world. But they will boo lack of effort. They will boo opposing players. They will boo bad calls by the umpires. And, yes, they'll boo Santa Claus.
The Santa Claus thing actually did happen back in 1968 at a Philadelphia Eagles football game. It helped cement the belief that Philadelphia is the town that boos the most, the best, the worst.
It was one of the last game of the year. It was right before Christmas. It was in Franklin Field, our old stadium. The Eagles had won two games that year, so the fans were just pissed off in general. And then the regular Santa Claus that they were going to use for this halftime show got sick. So they went into the stands to find guys in Santa Claus suits and see if they'd volunteer. And the only guy they found was this scrawny-looking, dirty suit guy. He was the worst-looking Santa Claus I ever saw. And they put him up on the sled. I guess they must have paid him something. And carted him around. And everyone, myself included, threw snowballs at Santa.
From WNYC and APM American Public Media, this is Freakonomics Radio. This week, boo who? Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Yeah, well, you too. Anyway, let's get back to Philadelphia. Franklin Field, December 15th, 1968. Santa Claus getting booed. The scrawny-looking Santa who got dragged down from the stands that night was named Frank Olivo. He was a native Philadelphian. You know how you could tell? Because here's what Olivo told the Philadelphia Daily News after he got booed and pelted by snowballs. He said, quote, "I'd have done exactly the same thing if I wasn't on the field." Now, keep in mind, Philadelphia is not just any city. Ed Rendell knows that. Well, if you wanted to get philosophical here for a minute, you could say, Philadelphia was the cradle of the political part of the revolution, at least. And if we didn't have a bunch of dissenters, we wouldn't have a country right now to start with.
Sure. I mean, Thomas Paine was the very first boo bird. he did it on his pamphlets, and they were remarkably effective in launching us on a new nation.
Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
I'm Stephen Dubner from New York.
Thomas Paine, sir. Very nice to meet you. I hope you're being wary of the loyalists up there in New York.
At this time of year, the loyalists aren't much of a threat.
Oh, well, that's very good.
In fact, I met up with a Thomas Paine impersonator in Philadelphia.
I like to write in taverns, actually.
So just like people write in Starbucks today, you would sit down in
Starbucks,
a tavern.
I'm not familiar with that.
Yeah, it's a coffee chain in the future.
It's a coffee house.
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah. In Thomas Paine's time, there was a tradition brought over from Europe called audience sovereignty. Audiences were expected to react, to interact. Huzzas, boos, hisses.
Well, it's just a hiss like a snake. And you get a number of people doing it. And it can carry quite a way.
This was nothing new, of course. Here's Richard Butch. He's a sociologist at Rider University.
From the ancient Greeks through the Elizabethan Shakespearean era into the 19th century, the early 19th century in the U.S., what we find is that in all of those areas, as well as in non-Western areas, what you find is the audiences actually were typically fairly active.
But today, booing lives on in sports, in some places at least, but overall, there's been a real decline in booing. I mean, come on, tell me the truth. Don't you sometimes have the urge, at the theater maybe, or during a meeting with your thick-headed boss?
I'm very conflicted about booing. On the one hand, I think it's a kind of verbal vandalism, and I'm always kind of annoyed when people boo around me. On the other hand, it's kind of one of the last true expressions of democracy.
That's Robert Lipsight. He's a writer, spent a lot of his career covering sports for the New York Times, especially the racial and social and political angles of sport. Unlike most of his peers, he didn't come to this as a fan. His memoir is called An Accidental Sports Writer. He's also an opera buff.
I saw the last few performances of Pavarotti a couple of years ago before he died. The voice was gone. And with the voice gone, it was also really hard to now forgive the fact that he was of the school that was known as Park and Bark. You know, these kind of hefty opera singers, you know, who would just kind of stand there.
And not a lot of acting.
Sing. Not a lot of acting. Not a lot of moving, Stephen. Mm-hmm. They would just park and bark. And he would do that. But in these final performances, it was even beyond, you know, the bark. The bark was gone. And the parking was almost ludicrous in the final scene where he was to die. I remember in Tosca, he was to die at a firing squad. You know, he was shot, you know, 20 times, and then he kind of lowered himself very slowly. He took a knee, as we say, in football. And I remember, you know, thinking, this is beyond feeling sorry for our hero or being pathetic, you know. You know, this guy should not be doing this. You know, if... You know, if there was any justice, people would boo. If I had any courage, I would get up and boo, but of course I didn't.
So wait a second. So you're describing a scenario where, according to the rules and regulations and morals of public performance, that this guy should have been booed, right? And you're saying he wasn't?
He wasn't.
And you didn't? You were there? You had the opportunity?
I confess.
Had you bought your ticket, or was it a freebie?
No, we're very expensive subscribers.
Let me say this. I've known Bob Lipsight for quite a while, and I like him a lot. I think he's a great writer. But the fact is, he's a grump, a grouch. If he won't boo something as bad as Pavarotti's Park and Bark, well, who is willing to cut loose?
So they come out on stage, and I go, boo!
Terry Teachout is a theater critic for the Wall Street Journal.
It was at New York City Ballet a number of years ago, not under the present regime, when the orchestra was in a terrible state of disrepair. And they performed a very difficult score by Igor Stravinsky to a ballet by George Balanchine, and they butchered it. And I was furious. And at the end, I booed. It's the only time I've ever done it in my life. I think I was the only person in the theater who was doing it, and I doubt if anybody knew why I was doing it, to be perfectly honest with you. But I felt a lot better for having done it.
It should be said that Teachout was at the ballet as a civilian that night, not as a critic.
I've never heard a single boo on Broadway as long as I've been reviewing, which is going on 9 years now.
How on earth can that be?
I often wonder myself, and the conclusion I've come to, other than some vague theory about how Americans are just basically nice people, which may or may not be true, is that tickets on Broadway cost an enormous amount. And so people feel, I think, obliged to vest themselves in the performance in a way that they might not if the ticket cost half as much. If you're putting out $125 for your seat, you want your show to be good. And I think that there may be some built-in bias there that inclines you to enjoy what you see.
Right. There is a phenomena that psychologists and economists talk about, the endowment effect. When something is yours and when you've attached value to it, you inflate the value of it because it
exactly
is yours.
Exactly right. And when you are endowing a performance with, assuming that you're bringing a date, $300 or more a pop, not including the incidental costs of travel, of having dinner, of all the things that go into a night at the theater, you're talking about a fairly substantial investment.
Yeah, and that makes sense. But let's entertain an alternate scenario. Let's pretend that there was a lot of booing on Broadway. Then we might say, well, it's because the tickets are so expensive. And when you pay that much, you expect that the product will be satisfactory to you, and it's not. And yet, that doesn't happen. So maybe it's not about the money.
Well, I can see a case for arguing that demand characteristics of the situation are shaping the way people respond on Broadway, except that people boo in opera houses in New York, and I've heard it. I've heard people absolutely tearing their hair and screaming with dislike, usually over productions. I've never heard an individual performer booed at the Met. What they boo is a production of a standard opera that is extremely eccentric in some way that is not to their liking.
So you think at root we should have more booing?
I would be encouraged if I heard it once in a while. I would not want the kind of full-scale incivility that is common in Italian opera houses. I don't want to see people throwing tomatoes. And I actually suggested as a kind of thought experiment what I called the silent boo, which would be you would install in your lobby a pair of plexiglass bins into which people dropped their programs as they left, one marked cheers and the other marked jeers.
Yeah, now I see the merit of that idea. But on the other hand, there's nothing remotely visceral about it. I mean, isn't that kind of the point of the boo? Is it reflects the audience's visceral reaction to and investment in the performer? And that's a different kind of thing than checking a box on a kind of, you know, customer satisfaction survey, right?
Well, there now, bear in mind that there's a big difference between checking a box on a customer survey and storming into the lobby and flinging your program into the jeers bin in full view of 100 other uh-huh. people. I think it's conceivable. And if somebody were to do it, I think that people would, in fact, see that as an outlet for expressing their feelings about the performance, and also one that would not just be cathartic, but might well supply useful information to the producers of the show. That said, I agree with you about booing. I think there's something really natural about booing. Sometimes when I see a really awful show, even though I didn't spend any money to see it,
and you're getting paid to see
it,
I'm
furious.
So the dynamic is exactly the opposite, and yet it's still frustrating.
Well, I paid with time. I paid with part of my life that I can never get back. I take people to shows because they always give us two press seats. And sometimes on the way out, I'll say, another 2 hours closer to the grave.
Coming up, where audience sovereignty and the boo are still alive and well.
He had keys missing on his little keyboard thing, and he was singing Stevie Wonder. That's just something you don't do. I said, boo, man.
And what do you do when you get the boo?
Support for the Freakonomics Radio podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of Freakonomics, NPR, This American Life, and other shows while on the go without downloading or syncing. With Stitcher Smart Radio, thousands of popular podcasts and programs are available on demand. Stitcher instantly delivers new episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone without syncing or downloading. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone or Android app stores or at stitcher.com/freak. Support also comes from audible.com. With more than 100,000 titles to choose from in all genres, including the radio talk show In Bed with Susie Bright. Titles can be downloaded wirelessly to your iPhone, Android, and Kindle. Audible suggests that Freakonomics listeners might enjoy listening to a podcast of Susie's 500th episode. To learn more about Audible and get a free download of Susie's 500th episode, go to audible.com/inbed.
From WNYC and APM American Public Media, this is Freakonomics Radio.
I've never been booed, but I think that's a bad thing, because I think in order to get booed, people actually have to have high expectations about you.
That's Steve Levitt, my Freakonomics friend and co-author.
And I don't think anyone's ever had high enough expectations about me to bother to want to boo at me. Like, you think about baseball, it's never the number nine hitter, the shortstop who bats 220 who gets booed. I mean, everyone knows he's terrible. It's a guy like Reggie Jackson or David Ortiz, who's Barry Bonds, the guy who's supposed to be good and then disappoints you, who ends up getting booed.
I get what Levitt's saying. If you've made the big time, if you're a professional, well, the boos kind of come with the territory. If you aren't getting booed, well, you probably haven't gotten where you want to go. Nobody boos a bad clown at a kid's birthday party, do they? They don't boo amateurs, do they? We visited the legendary Apollo Theater in Harlem for amateur night. Brace yourself.
Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready for amateur night?
Ella Fitzgerald, Billie Holiday, the Jackson 5, they all played amateur night here. But the place can be pretty unforgiving. Among the future stars who got booed, James Brown, Luther Vandross, and a 13-year-old Lauryn Hill. On amateur night, the MC encourages the audience members to vote with their voices.
Now, this is the only place where you get to show that you don't appreciate what you saw. So, if you don't like them, what you gonna do? And that will bring out the executioner, C.P. Lacey.
Tonight, C.P. Lacey is wearing red. Red suit, red tie, red hat. He's worked here for nearly 25 years.
I've been here for a minute.
He's the executioner, the guy that performers do not want to see.
It is my job to rid the stage of any unwanted acts. In other words, well, okay, you're singing your song, yada, 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 da, 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 boo! The band starts playing a totally different song than the one you're singing, and I come out tapping, and I'm telling them to get off the stage, and they don't even know what's happening because so much is going on. They're still singing their song. And then they kind of get the idea and say, I'm getting booed.
Backstage, dancers are running through their acts. Singers are warming up. Here's Ellis Gage.
I am 12 years old. I'll be singing Ain't No Mountain High Enough. Now if you need me, call me, no matter where you are, no matter how far. Don't worry, baby, just call out my name. I'll be there in a hurry, you don't have to worry. Cause baby, there ain't no mountain high enough. Ain't no valley low enough. Ain't no river wide enough.
Ellis didn't get booed, in part because he was really, really good, but even if he weren't, he would have been spared. At the Apollo, you're not supposed to boo a kid. But this next guy, he wasn't a kid.
I need more energy for Mr. Joshim Winter.
So let's see. You shouldn't boo kids, but it is okay to boo in the name of Jesus. Those are some of the rules of booing at the Apollo. Ed Rendell, the former governor of Pennsylvania, he's done a lot of thinking about the do's and don'ts of booing as well. He once wrote a newspaper column with the headline, Rendell's Rules for Booing. I wonder if we could walk through them quickly. You maybe give me an example of each one.
Sure.
You write that good-natured booing is always allowed. Explain.
Yeah, and I'd say good-natured booing, like, say, booing a popular politician. I remember once I got reelected as mayor with 81% of the vote, And the next night I went to a 76ers game. They made the mistake of introducing me and I got booed. But it was good natured. I would say probably 90% of the people in the stands voted for me. But that was good natured booing.
All right. So you write, booing a politician is always acceptable.
Any politician who ventures out on a field.
You've had that experience a few times, right? You've thrown out your share of first balls, and it doesn't go well, does it?
It never goes well. I threw out the first ball at the opening of Harrisburg's new stadium, and I gave the state, through me, gave half of the money, and I still got booed.
Now, that doesn't seem fair, does it? Rendell gets booed at a stadium that he helped fund. But if you're a politician, you've got to learn to live with the boo. You've got to know what to do with the boo.
I'm Steve Klayman, and I'm a professor of sociology at UCLA.
Klayman once wrote a paper about booing and applause in political speeches. He analyzed more than 40 hours of material, including some presidential debates.
Is Iran talking to Iraq about peace? You judge on the record. Are the Soviets coming out of Afghanistan? How does it look in a program he called phony, or some one of these marvelous Boston adjectives up there, and about Angola. Now we have a chance. Now, several Bostonians don't like it, but the rest of the country will understand. Now we have a chance.
That was George Bush the Elder in a Michael Dukakis debate in 1988. We don't actually hear Dukakis there. Talk to me about this one now.
Yes, I thought it was an excellent example of the way a speaker can respond to a booing response when it happens. Bush had a comeback for the booing that turned out to be quite effective. So he's talking about foreign policy, and in the course of his remarks, in an embedded, indirect way, he makes a derisive remark about Bostonians. And that gets people in the audience to begin to boo. He says several Bostonians don't like it, but the rest of the country will understand. This is a way, a method, if you will, for dealing with booing when it occurs. And the method he's using is to marginalize the booers, that is to characterize the people in the room who are doing the booing as not representing the majority, but rather a narrow, self-interested slice. So he managed to turn an episode of booing into a supportive episode of applause.
Right. He turned the boos back on the boo. It was a boomerang, I guess is what
that's
was,
right.
In our attempt to understand the boo, we've got one more story to tell you. And if you ask me, this one is the story of the ultimate boomerang.
My name is Johnny LeMaster. I am a sporting goods store owner at this time, own my own business and coach a little bit of baseball. And that's basically what I do.
Johnny LeMaster is being a little bit humble. He left out the part about playing Major League Baseball for 12 seasons, mostly for the San Francisco Giants. Now, he was hardly the best baseball player that ever lived. In fact, he was a shortstop with a career batting average of about 220, the very kind of player that Steve Levitt talked about, who usually isn't targeted for booing.
I'm just an ordinary person, but I've lived an extraordinary life, and that's all because of baseball.
During this long career years with the Giants, there comes a time, I believe in 1979, when the Giants fans there in San Francisco are in, I guess, a sour mood. The team is not doing as much winning as they'd like, and they got particularly unhappy with you. And that led to a situation. Can you walk me through that?
Sure. As you say, the team wasn't playing real well. I wasn't playing real well. And the booing started. I guess I became the whipping post, per se, if you want to call it that. And it escalated and started getting worse each game. Even when I just popped my head out of the dugout, it would be boo or something of that nature.
And what's it feel like from the athlete's perspective to be booed like that? I assume that you're trying hard, right? I think that everybody knows there's a difference between booing for when someone, doesn't put out effort and when they make a mistake. There's a big difference in those two things. So
they could have never booed me for a lack of effort or a lack of hustle. But an athlete wants to please his home crowd more than anything in the world. And it's a crushing, it's a thing that hurts so bad when your own fans boo you. But I want my fans to be pleased with what I'm doing because they're the ones that pay my salary. They're the ones that come in and cheer us on. They're the ones that care about us the most because we have some diehard Giant fans. And I'm still a Giant fan at heart, and I always will be.
Now, why was it you? Why were you the guy that they started to boo?
People are, I don't know how to say, fickle. Once it's something like that gets started, it just kind of snowballs. And at that month, I guess, I'd made a few errors at the wrong time and said a few things in the newspapers that I probably shouldn't have said at that time, being a young idiot kid.
What kind of things had you said in the newspaper, Johnny?
Well, I'd rather probably just keep that to myself.
Uh-huh. Was it about baseball or was it kind of off topic?
It was off topic. It was more about some political things that were going on in San Francisco.
Oh, that never works well, does it?
No, I'm a very conservative person, and that's more of the most liberal places that there is in the world. And some of the things I didn't say them to hurt anybody, but I said them to try to make people think.
This is San Francisco. This wasn't about homosexuality, maybe, was it?
It was.
Okay, so you're in San Francisco, and you say something that could be interpreted as a conservative view on homosexuality. That's not going to go over very well.
And believe me, it didn't.
The boos escalated. This went on for weeks. LeMaster was pretty unhappy about it. And finally, one night, lying in bed with his wife, she had an idea for how he ought to handle the boos.
The next day, I went in and talked to our equipment manager. I said, make me a jersey up with my number on it, and put, instead of my name, LeMaster, I said, put Boo on the back of it. And it hung in my locker for a couple of weeks, and I finally got enough nerve to put it on and wear it in a game. But I only got to wear it for the top half of the first inning. After the game, there's a letter laying on my chair in front of my locker. My general manager fined me $500 for being out of uniform. But here's the whole thing about it. The fans loved it, and the media loved it. It got the fans off my back, and it got the media off my back.
When you decided to wear the jersey, or I guess when you decided to make the jersey, what were you trying to say? Were you just trying to make fun of yourself? Were you trying to acknowledge that you heard the boos? Were you trying to boo the fans back? What was the kind of message, you think?
I was trying to give the fans a way, instead of booing Johnny LeMaster, that whenever they say they were going to boo, that they were actually cheering me because that was now my new name. But I had a good time with it, too, don't get me wrong. And, here we are still talking about it 30 years later. But here's, I guess, what brings it all back to reality. The last year I played, I was with the Oakland A's, and I'm sure you've heard of Reggie Jackson.
Sure have.
Reggie was on that team. It was the last year he played also. But we were up in Seattle, and I went down early for breakfast one morning, and I was there by myself. And about the time I got ready to order, Reggie walked in. He says, anybody sitting with you? I said, no, Reggie, come on, sit down, man. We'll eat breakfast together. And he came over and sat down. We chit-chatting a little bit, and he looked over at me. He said, I hear you get booed every once in a while. I said, Reggie, I did. He looked at me across that table, just eyeball to eyeball. He said, let me tell you something. He said, people don't boo nobodies. Now, why he told me that, I don't know, but he made me feel like $1 million.